Next up, I've got Summit County Councilperson Chris Robinson, who is on the line to give us an update on yesterday's meeting. Thank you so much for being with us, Chris.
You're welcome, Carolyn.
So, Jeremy Noisewall, after hearing from UDOT yesterday, it looks like they had made a presentation and the Citizens Against the Wall. Do they have a point? Are they being heard by UDOT?
I think UDOT's tried to listen to them and think they're being heard. Some of their opinions don't comport with UDOT's view of the rules, and such as what constitutes adjacency. The citizens have wanted to claim that the receptors should not just be the 27 that are around the wall, but the rules say something about it, those that are adjacent. And UDOT says that means those that share a common boundary, and the citizens wanted to expand that out much broader. But I think UDOT has tried to engage with the receptors. They're really the ones that are in charge, and has tried to propose things short of their original proposal, which was voted upon and approved by 93% of the receptors in the first round of balloting some months ago. And so UDOT now is going out to them again. Yesterday they went out to them with basically a berm about 11 feet tall that would only achieve a one to two decibel reduction, whereas the wall was achieving a minimum of five and up to seven decibels for the receptors. And apparently it's logarithmic, is the exponential. So when you the difference between 2 decibels and 7 decibels is not linear. It's a lot more.
It's like a Richter scale.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so.
And so they're going to send this out. But in order for that 11-foot berm to be accepted, 100% of the 27 receptors would have to reply back, and 100% would have to say, we want the lesser protection. And that seems very unlikely.
Right. So there has also been, though, criticism from CATW, Citizens Against the Wall, that the decibel reduction might be applicable for those benefited receptors identified. But there's this whole other community called, Jeremy's South Point, and that they're not allowed to vote. They're not allowed to be part of that. And at least this CATW group is saying that these neighbors are just as impacted, but nothing's really changed. UDOT is pretty much holding firm that there are only these 27 benefited receptors.
So UDOT believes that they're following precisely the rules, and that. These other receptors are not eligible. But those other potential receptors are not eligible.
And is that just some scientifically based assessment that they have measured those homeowners, property owners over there?
I can't say that. I don't understand spatially where they are relative to the wall. I understand where the wall is and where the 27 are, but I know that a couple of my colleagues, Kim and Roger, have had several, separate meetings with UDOT and along with our staff. And I think that I haven't seen any evidence to the contrary that they're, from our side, that have looked into it, that they're not following the rules.
Okay. UDOT also has been accused by CATW that they're not staying within their own guidelines as far as the cost parameters under which they can go ahead and build this. And some of the representatives from CATW just say it's simple math. Just do the numbers. So How do we as a county stand on that? Yeah.
Well, first of all, we as a county don't have a veto over this. This is not, you know, this is not something that we get a vote on. Secondly, these numbers, you know, to the extent that our staff have looked at them, they don't see it the same way that CATW see it. And, you know, this, I was listening, trying to determine whether it's an annual or perennial or biennial weed. This topic doesn't, I think it's at least a biennial and maybe a perennial. I can't seem to shake it.
It's a noxious weed, are you saying?
I'm not saying it's a noxious weed. I'm just trying to say that it has multi-year life.
Yeah, it's a tough one because we don't have any say, really. UDOT is going to do what they are going to do.
Yeah, I think that UDOT has, you know, even coming and asking us for this work session yesterday to explain that they've, you know, got it all. They showed three alternatives. One of them was a $10 million expanded berm that was supported by gabion baskets on the golf course side, would have required taking $5 million worth of the golf course's land and another $5 million to build, which, you know, was not cost feasible at all. Then the other one was the 11-foot berm that they're balloting. And then the proposal they had initially, which is combination of berms and walls that achieve the decibel reductions required. And, you know, it's interesting that the citizens, they have their perspective, but there's also 27 other citizens that 93% of whom really want this to happen and have to live with it every day. And so we haven't picked sides much. I mean, in the ideal world, I personally would rather not see a wall there. I don't live there either.
Yeah. Well, and Chris, it's water under the bridge, but the development was put in alongside a interstate highway where trucks and traffic were going to be increasing as population pressures increase. So I mean, it's, you know, we're talking 30 years ago now, of course, but it is an interesting consideration as we move ahead and make decisions on other developments along highways.
Yeah, the one minor silver lining is Glenn Wright, my colleague on the council, whispered to me yesterday. He said, when all these vehicles are electric, it might be a different story.
Yeah.
I'm not sure we're going to all be alive at that point, but hopefully we will.
Yeah, interesting. Well, so let's move on. You talked quite a bit about fire season coming up. What's your take? What's the council's take on the education efforts that are being put out by the county? Are there any other ideas that you have about what needs to happen with communication with the people who live here? We've been told, for all intents and purposes, it is a dramatically dangerous fire season coming up.
Yeah, I think that the fire season we're coming upon, as we've been told, is similar to what we had in 2012, probably. And although we've got a little reprieve with the cooler temperatures that we've had here in late May, and, you know, it could be, you know, for Memorial Day, it's not common to be hot. It looks like we're going to be cool, and we've had rain, and that's a two-edged sword, which can create, dries out. We've just got a bigger, to the bigger picture, it's like so many things in life. Until you are in the crisis, you don't appreciate the severity of the exposure that you face. And I think that we're not doing enough. I don't know how to do a lot more, but there are places in this county that, in the right conditions, are going to burn, and it's going to be catastrophic. And there's there needs to be a lot more done to create defensible spaces and reduce fuel loads especially around structures.
Should defensible space be part of our ordinance, or is it part of our ordinance?
It's not, and we've discussed that, whether we have the authority to mandate it. But you don't have to look very far to see what can happen when you have the right fuel conditions and low humidity and temperature and wind and a spark.
Sure. Can you give a non-wonky description of why maybe it would be difficult for us as a county to put defensible space into an ordinance? Is there something in the state legislative code that doesn't allow a city to do that, or what? What did you mean?
Well, I think, you know, our state legislature is very laissez-faire, and they bridle at efforts by their political subdivisions, by their counties, cities, of, you know, it sometimes fits into the bucket of either Big Brother telling them what to do or depriving them of property rights. Similar, and I don't know if this is the case, but, you know, we could mandate that everyone has to, new construction has to have solar panels on the roof. I think California just did that. The state would probably, there's probably somewhere in Utah code that says we can't do that. And it's in similar fashion, you know, this is a state that thinks people ought to govern themselves. And that we, you know, they take their own risks to some degree. And so I don't know for sure whether there is a prohibition in state code that would prevent us from, you know, I mean, and enforcing it's a big issue. How, you know, say we have an ordinance on the books that say you have to maintain 50-foot perimeter around your home of defensible space. That gets into people's landscaping, right? You know, and in Pine Brook or Summit Park, that landscaping is natural, but they're not, you know, they're going to be hesitant to go on a clear-cut perimeter. It's not as easy as it sounds. And then there's the other issue of whether we require fire-retardant building materials. My cedar shake roof out on Old Ranch Road is probably not one of those. A standing seam metal roof might be. You know, I don't know if an architectural-grade asphalt shingle roof is. And then, you know, there are some structures that if you have a bough that's on fire gets blown onto the top of your roof, it won't burn. Others, it just, you know, takes off. So it's more complicated, but having a dialogue about it like we're having this morning will help.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think that'll probably about wrap it up for us. Thank you for giving us a call. Appreciate it.
Have a great weekend.
You too. Bye now.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you, David. Well, next on the line, we have Snyderville Planning Commissioner Chairperson Bea Peck, and she's going to talk with us about the 4 hours that was spent on a meeting discussing one issue on Tuesday. Hi, Bea. Thanks for coming on.
Good morning. And time flies when you're having fun. So
Okay.
The 4 hours went quickly.
All right. Well, let's take a minute first and identify this location. It's on Bittner Road. It's a project that's being referred to as Lincoln Station. Can you talk to our listeners, tell us basically what is being proposed there? Apparently there were 3 votes taken by the commission. And, we've got, what, like 78 residential units? 5,000 square
feet.
Well,
3 votes were taken because there were 3 items, if you will. The first was a vote on whether to rezone, and then the second vote was to recommend the development agreement that had been proposed by the developer, and then also recommend under the conditional use process, the permit would have been proposed was also going to be recommended.
Okay.
So essentially, the crux of it was the rezoning it from 1 per 20 to what you could describe as a mixed-use area, which includes mostly residential, but some commercial. I think it was 5,000 square feet. And this project had initially come to us probably at least three years ago, if not earlier than that, and we were still in the process of changing the general plan and reviewing a lot of these areas to try to identify whether some of these areas that were under rural residential and traditional zoning could be looked at as potential sites to increase some density, to allow for some mixed use, and primarily along corridors that we felt would be appropriate, and with the hope that this would take some pressure, development pressure, off of other areas, and that we could, as a tool to contain, the sprawl of growth. So this developer has been working on this and came back to us within the last year with a well-developed plan. Our general plan had been approved, and within that general plan there was a caveat, if you will, under section 2.3 that we would not increase any density until all the current density in the Snyderville Basin had essentially been built out. And the only way to overcome that restriction would be a countervailing public interest, a public interest or benefit that would have enough strength to it that it would be worth doing or changing the zoning. And I'm going on a bit, I know, but this is the history of it. County Council and certainly the Planning Commission and everyone agrees that affordable housing is really a compelling interest, a priority for the county, and with that in mind, this developer came in with Lincoln Station with the idea of providing three times the amount of affordable housing that that an ordinary mixed-use development would have to offer. So instead of, for example, between 9 and 10 affordable units, this developer was offering 31. So it was of great interest to us. As I say, we'd gone through work sessions with this developer, and there was a consensus amongst the commissioners that the affordable housing was a strong component and had enough benefit to it that it was worth us making the recommendation that it go to the county council for further review.
So if you've got 5,000 feet of commercial space and 31 affordable units, what is the ratio of square footage of commercial workspace to workers? I mean, isn't one of the concerns that Ryan, I guess, was the only dissenting vote on the rezone, on the upzone. But what is that? What is that formula of commercial space to human beings servicing that?
Oh, I don't have that off the top of my head. We did ask those questions about whether creating commercial space would necessarily then create jobs, and then you would have employees filling those jobs who then would have a priority to fill the space. So the concern was that, you know, does that degrade the carrot of building additional affordable units because you're basically filling them right away and maybe bringing in people from outside the area to move to the area to take the jobs and then to take the spots. So, and that's not necessarily untrue, but that still does leave there's still 31 units, and we don't have them now. And even if we, you know, tried to take a stab at it and say, okay, let's say 50% of them might be taken by the employees that are working there and living there, that still leaves us another 50% that's available perhaps for the next tier in priority. So what we tried to do, too, is we recommended an option that the county council can look at, that 5,000 square feet could be converted to affordable units as well. So we left the door open for that. And I think at some point we just have to it's a desire in the community to create affordable housing. We have a developer that's willing to go above and beyond what would be the normal formula. It's in an area that when we were redoing the general plan, we recognized through some of the what we call the overlay zones that this area really would be susceptible to this kind of development and protect other areas. So those things all taken into consideration, the majority vote was to send it up to the county council.
Okay. And they'll consider this at the next meeting then?
I'm not sure what their timing is. We've made the recommendation, so next it goes to them, and the usual process will occur. I don't know if they'll have work sessions, but there certainly will be additional public hearings before they make their decision.
Okay, and it looks like food trucks was also postponed. That was on for discussion.
Yes,
you said you have a lot of concerns about that.
We not so much concerns, just that we had run out of time. We did want to spend a fair amount of time on it, and at that point, the proposed ordinance needed just additional comments and work. And what we agreed to do was that the commission, we would be sending in our comments to staff to be incorporated into the document, so that at the continued public hearing, which I think is June 24th, we'll have a document that's a little fleshed out a bit more. We'll incorporate more of concerns and comments that we have, and I think it'll be a more finely tuned document. And then that's a good time then to bring it to the public and entertain the public's concerns and questions.
Sure.
It's really more mechanical than anything else.
Okay. And you didn't have another 4 hours to give that night, I guess?
Didn't have another 4 hours to
okay.
give.
Okay. Well, that'll have to do it, Bea. Thank you so much for calling in.
Yo, thank you. Thank you for your time.
Bye now. Good morning. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. It is 8:41. Our next guests are historians Steve Latham and David Nicholas. They're here to talk about the B-18 crash into Iron Mountain in 1941. And this weekend, the Park City Museum, in partnership with Park City American Legion Post 14, will hold a Memorial Day service to honor the Army Air Corps crash. Welcome, David. Welcome, Steve.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
You're very welcome. So what can people expect? David, why don't you start off and tell us what can people expect with this event?
Well, Steve and I began this project 2 years ago, researching this crash. It was largely forgotten in time. And, you know, as a result of our research, we've been in touch with there were seven crewmen on the plane. Steve has been in touch with family representatives from all seven of them. On Monday, we'll have representatives from six of the families, a total of 32 people from the families attending the event. They're coming from eight different states, from far away as Louisiana and Alaska. And Steve has played a key role in orchestrating everything with the Hill Air Force Base, American Legion, Air National Guard, National Guard. And I'll let Steve talk a little bit here, too.
Well, so let me ask Steve then, are you two solely historians, or are you aviators and historians? Or
no.
How did you stumble into this? What made you decide to pursue this kind of research?
Well, several years ago, we had heard the story of the B-18 bomber that had crashed on Iron Mountain. And I'm actually a retired teacher, and so I was interested in history. I taught social studies and history, and so became interested in the history part of it. And then having been raised in Park City, I became interested in the story that David was talking about. And we thought that we could go up on Iron Mountain and find actually one of the old engines from the plane. But as we began our research up there on the mountain, we really had a hard time finding anything, any remains or any parts of the plane. And as we began to look at the story behind the plane, it seems like it was kind of lost in history that a plane had crashed on Iron Mountain, and it was just 2 weeks before Pearl Harbor, and so this whole story became lost. And we, in our original thought, called this Lost and Found. The story had been lost in history, the plane had been lost, the story of the airmen had been lost, and it became our goal, through our research, to delve into this and write more than just, you know, the basic fact that there had been a crash on Iron Mountain. And as we've begun our research, the stories of each of these airmen and the story of the crash itself have just become almost overwhelming. And what we've learned is, you know, it's each time, we always say that when one door closes for us or we come to the end of what we were looking for, another door opens. And there are so many threads now to this story that it's almost consumed all of our time.
So either of you can answer this, but what was an airplane doing up there? Where was it out of? And was that the then Air Force that the United States was ready to go to war with?
Right. This was a B-18 bomber, and it had flown over to Denver that afternoon to pick up Major Robert Pirtle, who was the commander of the 88th Reconnaissance Squadron, which was based here at Fort Douglas. And the plane flew over. They were actually part of a secret operation just prior to World War II beginning. The 88th Reconnaissance Squadron was going to fly B-17 bombers to the Philippines as part of a protection. The thinking was that the Japanese would attack the Philippine Islands before Pearl Harbor, and it was a surprise when they did attack Pearl Harbor. And so the plane was flying back from Denver, bringing Major Pirtle back. It ran into a tremendous thunder, hail, snow storm as it came in over Park City. And as the plane came over Park City, there were seven fellows on board, and six of them bailed out of the plane, including the pilot. The plane was then uncontrolled and circled over Park City, flying up the west side and then circling around, making a 270-degree turn and coming back down the east side. The men had bailed out somewhere up over, we figure, you know, by the Silver King Mine, the old Silver King Mine. As they floated down in their parachutes in this tremendous storm, the plane came back around, and they were dead center. They were the target of the plane as it came around uncontrolled. It struck Major Pirtle's parachute, and he was killed instantly, fell to the ground, we think somewhere almost on the hillside down there by the Park City Cemetery. The plane then flew on uncontrolled. One of the fellows, Sergeant Jack Anderson from Ogden, was unable to get a parachute on and get out in time, and he went down with the plane as it crashed into Iron Mountain. And so that story in itself was quite unique. And then as we've researched each of the fellows that was on board the plane, they all have unique stories. And we've lectured, we've written, we have more plans to write about this. And we have felt such a kinship with these pilots, or with the pilots and the airmen on board, that we felt it's almost our duty now to tell their story and to pay honor and tribute to them and their courage that they showed that evening. And then, of course, to recognize the sacrifice of the two airmen that lost their lives that evening. And so we're compelled to do this.
Wow, what a story. So, David, why don't you give us a rundown of what all is going to happen? I understand there's going to be a bus up to the site where the family members will be able to see the actual site.
Yes. So, as far as it relates to the activities on Monday, You know, we've made arrangements to have representatives from Hill Air Force Base, the Air National Guard, the National Guard, the local VFW and American Legion. They'll be playing a key role. As I mentioned, we have 32 representatives from 32 family members from six of the seven airmen. We've made arrangements for a bus, and thank you, Park City Municipal, for making that those arrangements. And we will have trips to take family members up to the crash site. The plane actually hit Iron Mountain twice. It had a glancing blow just below the summit, about 200 feet below, and then it started to disintegrate and then crashed in the saddle. Most of the impact area has been obliterated by development, but there's a portion where there's no imagination necessary to see where something tore into the ground, because the aspens in that trench are below the height of the aspens surrounding it. And once we found the actual final impact zone, we were able to find shards of the plane.
Wow, it's going to be quite emotional.
Yes.
So where do things start in the morning? Will they start at the cemetery, at the Park City Cemetery, with the usual Memorial Day services that are held there?
It's going to start at 9. We're expecting a large turnout. We're recommending that people park in the Wells Fargo parking lot and go over there. Some of the family members that will be attending are infirm, so we want them to be able to park in the cemetery. But for able-bodied folks, we're recommending they park at Wells Fargo.
Okay.
I think that's something we want to emphasize too, Carolyn, is that we are working in conjunction with the Park City American Legion Post. And although we're focusing on these airmen and the crash that happened here, we are celebrating, and, you know, it is a tribute to all of our veterans and all of the men in uniform, men and women in uniform now, and those in the service. And so even though it's, you know, a focus on the on this airplane and these airmen, we are, you know, we know that it is Memorial Day, and so it's kind of a combination.
Yeah.
And David always talks about it takes a village, and the number of people and the number of groups that have supported us, the Park City Museum, and, you know, just everyone that's involved, it's tremendous, and we really appreciate that.
Well, sounds like it's going to be quite a day. So thank you, gentlemen, for coming in.
Yes, thank you.
And, enjoy. Hopefully the weather will hold out for you all. That's
thank you.
That's Steve Latham and David Nicholas, both historians who are here to talk about the B-18 crash from 1941. So thank you again.
Thank you.
Our final guest today is, there are two guests, Parley's Park Elementary School music teacher, Aaron Webb, along with the Arts Youth Empowerment Director. Her name is Anna Stampfli, and she's founder of this organization, and they are here to talk about the International Festival going on at Parley's Park today. Let's start with you, Anna, please. Yeah, it looks like you've brought your violin.
So this is actually a violin that was created by a Treasure Mountain student, actually my daughter, Lauren Stampfli. I used it to inspire children in the second grade in Ms. Bott's class it's integrated learning. It's STEAM learning. It is going to be called My Violin, My Community. It supports their Common Core study in the second grade of community. And the children, and again, I use this violin to inspire them, the children took parts and aspects that they learned of the community with Ms. Bott and visually displayed it on violins that my program donated to the project. This violin was created to demonstrate the power of the iconic business I Love Moo and Java Cow here in Park City. And the business donated free ice cream gift certificates to the orchestra that I created for when they perform tonight. They've achieved a goal. And so this portion of my program is how my mission is to connect education, the arts, children, inspiring learning, and businesses in our community to support the arts and integrated learning.
It's amazing. Would you describe it? There's a cow.
Right.
There are
so
udders on there.
Right. My daughter took the violin and, in essence, made it look like a cow. She painted the cow's skin pattern on it. And then on the front of the violin has the Java Cow logo, the little cow. And on the back, She wrote I Love Moo and Smoothies Too, which is their you know, their motto for the I Love Moo store. Marcy and Kenny Davis, again, are really supportive, a business in our community supportive of the arts and the program.
That's great, Anna. Well, Aaron, let's just kind of get an idea of what we can expect today. Timing, what's going to happen, performances, and a showcase of artwork and integrated types of displays, that type of thing. So let's hear about that.
Absolutely. Well, this is the third year we've had the festival. And we're going to have an indoor and an outdoor stage, just complete with music and dance. We'll have a gallery art walk through the first and fourth grade hallways, also in the library. There will be projects hanging in the lobby. We plan on having two food trucks. And so it's just a big celebration of our students' talents and hard work.
Are these food trucks going to be of international flavors?
One is Lola's Street Kitchen from Heber, and I believe they do Greek-American fusion. And the other is called Yoli's Street Tacos.
Yes.
Forgive me, Yoli's Street Tacos, but they were here last year, and they're delicious.
Okay, and so there's going to there will be some children, elementary age, performing in a concert.
Yes, so
an orchestral concert.
Through this fabulous partnership that I was able to benefit from in partnering with Parley's Park and Trailside Elementary Schools, I established an integrated learning youth orchestra. The reason I call it integrated learning is because some of these students in the orchestra that will perform tonight, and they are from kindergarten through fifth grade, they will be performing on the violin. They participated in the integrated learning STEAM projects as well. So when people come tonight, and there are going to be some VIPs from across the state, like Vicki Bournes and Jean Irwin from the Division of Museums and Arts in Salt Lake, coming tonight to see the power of these projects and how the children embrace learning and become partners in their own learning process through this initiative. Getting back to the orchestra, they're going to be performing Let It Go from Frozen, The beginner classes are going to be performing Mozart's Melody along with my orchestra. And in one case, a little girl from Trailside Elementary School, Charlie Chambers, arranged the piece, The 29 Counties of Utah, which is something they learn in elementary school. She listened to it, she composed it and wrote it, and then the orchestra is going to play it. She's going to solo with a friend of hers, Molly, and they're going to perform tonight with the orchestra. So it really is the power of music, the power of the arts, the power of partnership, the power of community that has brought this, to Parley's Park International Arts Festival tonight.
So Trailside, it's at Parley's Park, but Trailside students will also be participating because they've been part of the program.
Correct.
Will this be expanding at some point into the other elementaries?
Yes. So I am lucky enough now to be partnered with the Compass. And my program is going to be at all four elementary schools offered in the after school through the Compass starting next year.
Do you offer this for adults?
So back east where I started my program, and I do have programs back east as well still, I do involve parents, community, support for the children so that parents can learn the same instruments their children are learning and take part in the process at home with their children. So, yes, it is open to the entire community.
And this event today, let's get a rundown again on time, 4:30?
Yep, we'll kick off things at 4:30. We'll go through about 7:30. On the indoor stage, you'll see a lot more video. My third graders, for example, created stop motion videos of phases of the moon using Oreo cookies. And then they imported these videos into GarageBand and created original film scores. So a lot of the technology pieces will be on the inside. And concurrently outside, we'll see the violin performance and then shortly after performances from our dual immersion teachers and students. Brilliant, colorful costumes, music. It's just a celebration of what these students have accomplished. And one thing that's important to me and to Anna is doing what's best for kids. And
absolutely.
That means giving them opportunities to shine, like arranging music, the 29 counties, arranging that song.
Yeah. Giving children the opportunity to shine and, being a community that supports the child and the student being part of their own learning process. I think that's something that, you know, as a nation of educators, we've lost sight of. You know, we want to get them to learn. We have state exams and we feel pressured. So something that I want to stress is how can we as a community support teachers, support administrators, and support children in exploring education? They will learn better.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be an amazing event. So thank you so much for coming in. That's Anna Stampfli and Aaron Webb talking about the Parleys Park International Festival tonight, 4:30.
Thank you.
You've been listening to